Good morning, everybody. On an earlier start here with This Is Your Racing Life for this week and for next week, and thrilled to say that I'm joined by one of our most popular and most talented horse trainers we have certainly here in Victoria, and that's Rob Griffiths. G'day, Rob.
G'day, Brian.
Good to catch up with you because I've got to let the cat out of the bag. We're out here at the yearling sales, and it's the last few days to the lead-up to tomorrow, Sunday, and this is when it all begins. It's sort of like the dress rehearsal, really, as we get ready.
Yeah, it is. It's exciting times. It's very the most crucial part of a racehorse trainer's business is to buy the right one. So a lot of work goes into it, and it's exciting. And we all live in optimism. Let's hope we get the right one this week.
So you guys, you've been pretty lucky with the weather through the week leading up to the sales, which, as I say, commence tomorrow, the Sunday. How much time do you spend out here?
Pretty much all day, every day. I come out, started on Tuesday, and spent Tuesday until 4:45 and Wednesday until after 5. Wednesday was a bit difficult with the hot winds. Horses were misbehaving. And the same Thursday, Friday, and then today, and I'll duck back to the races at Caulfield, and then out here all day, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday for the bidding.
Of course, you've got a day job and you're a horse trainer, so you've got to be up early in the morning to work the horses.
Yeah, it feels like we need a bit more than 24 hours in a day at the moment. Yeah, it's a long day, you know. We start at 4 a.m, so, you know, early morning, and then do your track work, and then off to the sales, fight all that peak hour traffic that we have to deal with, and then out to the sales. So it's a long day, and then throw in the night meeting, Mooney Valley in the middle of all of that on Friday night. So it's a lot of work, but anyway, I signed up for it, Brian, so.
There's no doubt about that. You've got to try and answer this, and no one seems to be able to give me the definitive answer. And people outside racing say to me, why do they work horses early in the morning?
Well, I think it's the most asked question for the right reasons, but I think the answer is a multitude of answers, and it is convenience. Our conditions get quite hot in the summer, so you want to get in and out early. You want to get your work done early so that you can go to the races, so you can do all the other jobs you have to do. You want to get the work done early so your horses have time to have a rest in between the afternoon shift. You want to allow enough time for track riders to earn a living so they can start riding work at 4, they can work till 10, they get 36 hours a week, they're not darting off to a second job. So there's a multitude of reasons why you want to do that. You know, you want to have time for your farriers that come in during the day, your vets and all the other people that are required to do the work. So I think for the multitude of all of those reasons rolled into one, it's just easier to start work early, get everything done and have your day organised.
This probably explains why horses have got long faces, because you say you get up at 4 o'clock and your staff's expected to do the same thing, but what about the horse? Have you ever asked him?
Yeah, true. It's they like to be structured. Horses are a herd animal, so they like to be structured, and so getting them into a routine is quite funny. I've found they prefer that, you know. Sometimes when they're out of routine, if you start changing things around, they get a little bit sort of confused as to what's going on. So,
do you have to wake them up?
Yeah, sometimes. Most of the time they get into a time zone themselves. You know, they're used to the lights going on at 4 a.m. and starting work, and we try to work pretty regular. We start at 5 a.m. on Sundays, but most of the time, as soon as the lights come on, they're up and at it and ready to go.
Your life has been racing, and that's why we're talking to you. A very successful apprentice, about 250 winners, would that be right?
Yeah, it was around there, and it was a great part of my life. I loved every second of it, and didn't fully ride. You know, retired just before I turned 21, and had a couple of rides in 6 months later, but found it too difficult to keep the weight off. Had a weight problem. Probably still have it a bit, Brian, actually, but anyway. But that was a great part of my life. I loved every minute of it, and it was a great adrenaline rush winning a race as a jockey. It's a different satisfaction as a trainer. Both rewarding, just different satisfactions.
You rode for some of the best, the Hall of Famers, people like Colin Hayes and Lee Friedman, and the best that we can put up. What did you learn?
Well, I was very lucky early in my career that my boss said to me, surprisingly, I was only knee-high to a grasshopper in the size 4 foot, and he said, you're going to get too heavy, which shocked me a little bit. Wasn't long after, I was a size 8 foot and struggling with my weight. So he gave me a really good advice, and I did my apprenticeship at Mortialik at Epsom Training Centre at the time. So there were some champions there. Manicato had not long retired, and there was Ross McDonald had Group 1 horses everywhere, and there was just a stack of superstar horses. And our next-door neighbour, Johnny Marr, won the Cup in 85, or we got there in 80. 83 and Black Knight won in 84 and What a Nuisance in 85. So it was the mecca of training. So I got to watch all of those wonderful trainers and then had the opportunity to ride for C.S. Hayes and Friedman and all the fantastic trainers of that era, all for timeless, really. So I pricked my ears and listened to everything I could and tried to watch as much as I could see, and knowing that my future in racing was not going to be in the saddle, then I was lucky enough to team up as a foreman for Tony Vassell. I was his stable rider until I couldn't ride the weight. He was a young up-and-coming trainer, and we all know how successful he's been, and you know his success in training with Caulfield Cup and Elstrom travelling the world and so on was brilliant. So I had a really, really wonderful grounding, and it's been so beneficial to me.
Now, your brother, of course, Rodney, highly successful as a jockey. He's been out of it for a while. So here we are. We had two R. Griffiths, Rodney and Rob. Give us a bit of background about the family. How did this sort of happen?
Yeah, I remember my mum saying to me when I was young, she named me after Bobby Darin, the singer. So my middle name is Darren, of course. So, and I'm not sure how it ended up with Rod and Rob, but it was quite funny and a stroke of genius from my boss, Bob Scarlett, when I started riding, knowing there was going to be confusion, because back then, as you're well aware, in the paper it was always just R. Griffiths or H. White or P. Highland. There was no, it didn't elaborate from that. So I said to my boss, maybe I should be D. Griffiths, so people don't get confused. And he said, no, you're R. Griffiths. That's it, simple as that. So the first day of riding at Moe Cup meeting, it was actually my first TAB meeting at Moe Cup Day on the Tuesday. They used to have a two-day Latrobe Valley meeting. And we had like 6 hours of free advertising on back then, 3DB or 3UZ, whatever it was back then. And it was just, hang on, R. Griffiths has got two rides in this race, because Rodney had a full book and I had about four rides. And for four of the races, everyone was trying to work out who's R. Griffiths on, and hang on, there's two. It was a bit like Abbott and Costello, who's on first. And it was quite funny, and it worked out well. I had all this marketing and free advertising and come out and won on the horse. And then the next day, we're back at Moe again, and I won again. So I had a dream start, and it just kicked off from there. So it was fantastic.
What about your dad?
Well, Dad wanted to be a jockey, and he's not a tall person, but in that era, he was way too big to be one. But he spent a lot of time breaking in some really superstar horses with a gentleman named Dick Porter. He did a lot of breaking for Angus Arm and Asco, broken a lot of their star two-year-olds. So Dad was always in the horses, as was my mum, and as was Rodney being 2 years older. From the time I can remember, all he wanted to do was be a jockey. I watched them, and they got injury after injury, broken bone after bone. So I thought, bugger this, I'm going to stay on the ground and I'm going to be a vet. That's what I'm going to do. So I didn't start riding until I was a bit older, because I thought my feet were safer on the ground. Like school, so I thought I'd go down that path of being a vet. But once I started doing work on weekends with my brother, being 2 years older, and he started race riding, I just loved it. Fell in love with being a jockey and come home and said to Mum and Dad, that's what I want to do. I want to be a jockey like my brother Rod and follow in his footsteps if I can. And that's what I did, and I loved every minute of it.
We're talking, what, 25 years ago?
Yeah, I went into the stables, 25 years. I'm 47 now, so I went in the stables at 14 years of age and about 23 days or something like that, and started working on the 3rd of September, I think it was, that year, and, been in the stables ever since.
You've seen some amazing changes just from the riding situation of what the boys and girls are doing now. There wouldn't have been too many of the girls riding back in those times, but... With the Paynes, the Payne family, they were sort of, they broke the ceiling in many ways, didn't they?
They did. They've been a remarkable family in a multitude of ways, but especially, in terms of gender, fairness and equal opportunity. Back when I was riding, there was the two girls that probably broke the mould a bit was Louise Bonella and Teresa Payne, and then the whole Payne dynasty carried on from there. So and now there's a lot of girl riders and there's a lot of female trainers, and everyone's succeeding really well. I think Gay Waterhouse really helped the female trainers along. There's a lot of equal opportunity out there now.
When I go to the stables or to track work or even at the race days when you see the strappers come in, majority are female.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that a lot of the girls, I know when my daughter was growing up, she's 22 now, but they love being around the horses and dialing them up and getting them ready for shows and dressage and different events. And especially in the Cranbourne area where I train, there's a lot of local pony clubs and so on. So you get a lot of the girls that like to do that. And that carries on to the yearling preparations, like this week where they dial them all up, and then it carries on to race day where they, you know, want to get best presented and, you know, make sure the horse looks at his or her absolute best. So I do think we probably see... I haven't done the stats, but, you know, it's probably a bit more girls in there than there is the guys. But yeah, it's great to see, though.
You know, Rob, when you, even out here at the sales yards, looking at yearlings, at the training track on race day, there's still a great element of danger, isn't there, around these animals?
Oh, there is, and it's, we're constantly having staff meetings with my team, and... I'm always saying to them and reminding them how easy it is to get injured. Actually, most of my injuries have come from your quiet old horse that you take for granted, because you get a bit complacent and you think, oh, you know, he or she's all right, they're quiet, they've been around a long time. But you've got to remember, they're half a ton, and if they take fright and step the wrong way, or they're a flight animal, so if they kick out at something that scares them and you're in the line of fire, next minute you're injured or got a broken leg or bone or whatever the case is. So you do have to be very careful, and I think that... I think that side of racing, though, in all aspects has improved a lot. I think that there's a lot more awareness out there, and I think that our stable hands and that these days in attendance are probably much more attentive to safety. But yeah, you've got to be very careful.
Yeah. With the boys and girls that work in the stables, and most are driven by the love of the animal, as you say, are they being paid enough? Are they being looked after compared to other sort of choices of work?
I would say not. I would say even stables like us that pay above the award, I don't think it's really enough for what they do. For, you know, they get out of bed at ungodly hours of the morning and do it for the love of the horse. But the problem that you have is that trying to fit, you know, 3 hours of labour plus admin into your workstation each day, and then if you add that up and then put it out to a daily training rate, all of a sudden it gets very, very expensive, and then it becomes difficult for owners to possibly participate in racing. So I think the trying to keep participation up to a max and create opportunity for trainers probably creates a platform where trainers are competing and really training. Sometimes their retail price potentially could be under their cost price. You know, we have 73 days or something of the year we pay double rates, 52 Sundays straight away, plus your public holidays, and we work 365 days, and we don't charge, you know, double training rates on those days. So it'd be nice to charge more so you can pay the strappers and the attendants that work with the horses more, but it is what it is, and that's the industry as it is at the moment. Maybe moving forward it's something we can identify, and I think once more awareness is out there with more so the participants and owners that realise how much work goes involved, then we might be able to stump it up a bit more so we can pay them a bit more.
Interesting you say that, because it's very timely about the Sunday rates. It's in the press now.
Yeah, well, that's it. You know, that's the thing, is that, you know, we're an entertainment industry, and every time there's a public holiday on, you know, entertainment comes out to the fore, and that's what racing is, you know, all the Boxing Day meetings and the public holiday meetings, New Year's Day and all that sort of stuff. So with all the Sunday racing and the night meetings and so on, there's so much more penalty rates and so on, which is rightly so, but it does push the price of everything up, you know.
Yeah. Special guest this morning, horse trainer and one of the best in the business, is Robbie Griffiths. We'll take a break. We're here for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating life. Talking with Rob Griffiths this morning on This Is Your Racing Life. Former jockey, had to get out of the game a bit too soon. Would you have liked to have played on, ridden on, but beaten by weight?
Yeah, I would have liked to. I felt at that particular time when I started training, I didn't feel as though youth and young trainers were getting possibly the opportunities that maybe they do these days. To me, it felt like when we started training, the established trainers were so dominant, and you know, I was only 22 years of age when I started training. And
who's going to give you a horse?
Correct. I mean, a lot of people that could afford to race horses probably wouldn't trust their own children at 22 with a, you know, with a vehicle that might cost $100,000 as a yearling. So, you know, when I started, you start with broken down horses or very cheap yearlings, and you try to rehabilitate them, and you have one runner every so many months because you just don't have the opportunity to go to the track. But my wife and I had a theory that it was in the middle of a recession that Paul Keating said we had to have, and we thought if we can get some experience now and learn as we go and work, by the time we've cut our teeth and learnt enough, when the opportunities come our way, we'll capitalise on them, you know. So whether rightly or wrongly, we started back then, but it's worked for us, so we're happy.
Was that the era of the continuation of the dominance of Lindsay Park from Colin Hayes then to David Hayes got his licence 1st of August 1990? Friedmans were a giant force in racing. So you take those two operations, there's not much room for anyone else.
Didn't leave pretty much room for anyone else, you know, and they were so dominant, those stables, and it was very much, unless you were part of that model, you didn't get a look in. And so to start, you know, now when I think of it now, I think I was crazy starting at that time, but it gave myself a chance to build a stable, and probably because I've always been a loyal sort of natured person, and I had some owners I was riding for, and it was inevitable that as soon as I started training, they were going to, whatever horse they had, they wanted me to train the horse. And actually my first winner was owned by a gentleman named Dudley Edgerton, and it was a horse called Star View, and his only race, he only won two races in his career. His first one, I rode him as a three-year-old for a good trainer at Mortyalik called Barney Dowie, and he kept bowing his tendon, and 3 years later I trained him to win his second race and my first winner as a six-year-old with Dale Short on. So that was the sort of client base and friendship you had with the people you rode for. So you sort of feel like you're letting them down if you don't go out and give it a crack as well. So I had that sort of mindset, and anyway, rightly or wrongly, I might have been too young, but it worked, and here we are now.
Did you name your stables after that horse? Because that's what you trainers do. The best horse you've had or something that's been so significant. I remember Bart Cummings had Saintly Lodge, Leilani Lodge, it was the same stable.
Yeah, well, we haven't gone down that path, and you know, maybe we'll have a quarterback theme or something like that, I'm not sure. But yeah, I mean, the horses that you come over in throughout your career, some of them aren't necessarily Group 1 winners, but they're fantastic horses, and they've played a big piece in your growth and development of your business. And we didn't have any money when we started, so any success that you have, you put back into your business. So some of these horses were just fantastic horses, Spring Theme and Go Rami and horses like that, that just went through and won on the right day and just did all the right things for us.
You mentioned the quarterback, and gee whiz, what a ride. You know, winning the Newmarket Handicap last year, your first Group 1, a race worth more than $1 million. It doesn't get any better than that. He's such a wonderful horse, a horse that came through the sale here, the Melbourne sale. 10 runs, I think, up the straight of Flemington for 5 wins and placings. And then we see how quickly it goes pear-shaped, like last week at the Lightning Stakes before they jumped.
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, we were riding a crest of a wave. Friday night, we'd had a double at Moonee Valley with not expensive horses. Dance with Fontaine was 2,000 out of Inglis, and Deja Blue, I think, was 60 out of Inglis. And we roll into the Group 1 the Lightning the next day, thinking, you know, we're a chance, and then it all turns pear-shape, and our horse was, he actually, when he reared, he slipped, lost his hind feet, and then he thrashed around, as a horse will do when they're on the ground. And when he started out under the front and tried to stand up, I just thought, that's it, he's going to do something horrible, and I'm worried he might break his neck or something stupid. And thank God for the horsemanship of the barrier attendants. They absolutely put themselves in harm's way in the best interest of our horse, and we're forever grateful for their efforts. It's just incredible. And as disappointing as it was, I actually left Flemington relieved that I still had a horse, because I thought that he could have been really, really badly hurt. So, yes, it's put a big dent in what's going to happen this preparation, and are we still going to be on target for the Newmarket? Possibly. But the fact that we've got a horse to talk about like that, yeah, we're forever grateful for the three guys that helped out.
Very well said. I, as a race caller last week for SEN, watching that, and I knew that a start was imminent. I reckon he was just about to hit the button, and then I saw a horse scramble and thrash, and they toss themselves around so hard in the gates when something upsets them. And then I saw his neck come and protrude underneath the gates. So I thought, oh, he's going to be wedged here, you know, and that's the gates are leaning on their back. Where's the jockey? He'd been thrown out the back or jumped out the back. But they get pinned under there, and they can do more harm. You know, they can break their back. Anything can happen.
Absolutely, and the weight of those barriers and trying to lift them, and I thought, please open up so he can get loose or something. But when he was pinned there, and I couldn't believe Eli, how he had the quarterback in a headlock to hold him down. It was just an amazing effort. So over the shock of it all, and then the collateral damage of the race, you know, you felt sorry for your opponents there, and, you know, my mates were sure Matherick at Cranbourne. And
did those horses get kicked, or what happened to them?
Aruju got kicked, so he got kicked, so I could understand him being scratched, but I spoke to Tom Dabernick on the Sunday and apologised, felt sorry, you know, for them guys. They didn't have a runner because of that. He said Fattenau was fine, so I think just with all the... It would have been difficult for the vets. It was a really difficult time. There was sprinters were all fresh, and Mick Price's good colt was losing the plot, and Headley was losing the plot, and it throws a whole question mark over the form of the race. So as a passionate racing person, to have the collateral damage of all that happening as well, not just our own horse, was disappointing for everyone involved. But I must say, I was delighted that our horse will get to fight another day. You know,
you've been very loyal to Joggy Max Allen, and he must be very loyal to you.
Yeah, well, I think as an ex-jockey, I feel as though there's... I know when I was riding, there was a lot of jockeys that I thought were very talented that might not necessarily been, you know, end up in the Hall of Fame, or they might not win the Group 1 successes that they should because they didn't get their opportunities. So I think that there's probably, you know, even though we've got some absolutely superstar jockeys, and Victorian racing is very blessed, we've got some superstar riders, there's no doubt about that. But I feel as though there's a lot of riders there that probably could have better CVs if they were given that opportunity. And Matthew turns up every day, he works for the stable. So I feel as though if he does the right thing, why shouldn't he be given the opportunity? He won't ride him his whole career. There'll come a time he won't get the weight like he did when Newitt rode him, and there'll be times he'll be suspended or whatever the case is, or there might be a time where the ownership group might just want to try someone else. But I try to give Matthew as many opportunities as his weight allows. And there's some good young riders there. We've had some nice apprentices along the way that have been terrific talents, like Luke Curry and so on. And Jai McNeil does a lot of riding for us, and Benny Thompson and Bo Mertens. There's some really good talent in Cranbourne. And my young apprentice, Nathan Punch, is starting to go all right. So I think that if jockeys do the right amount of work, I think they should be rewarded. And I think we've seen that a lot with Peter Moody and Luke Nolan. You know, and that association grew into, you know, 37 Group 1 winners together or something like that. So it was amazing. So I think that hopefully we can have some sort of success with that, but it's always going to be difficult for Matt because of his weight. He can't ride under a certain weight, so that's always going to restrict him.
I think he's been on your horse, the quarterback, 25 of his 30 starts, and the other two were Craig Newitt and Young Parnham and Mark Zahra.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, I'm very fortunate that the ownership group that we trained for have always given me full autonomy to do what I have to do. And part of that is if the guys that are riding for us on race day are doing the right job and they're turning up for training, then as a trainer I get better feedback rather than utilising the services of a rider that might know nothing about how the week went and how the horse has eaten and how his training's gone and so on. So if I can, and I try to use the riders that work with me, because I think that gives you a better result for the ownership group and the horse in question. So that's what we try to do, and luckily enough that our owners can see that.
I don't think there's any other sport that gives you the highs and the lows and the kicks in the guts that racing can deliver as a trainer or as an owner, as we all know. Tell me about 2 years ago. Here we are, Blue Diamond Day today. Tell me 2 years ago about Burnstone.
Yeah, it was amazing. We bought it's a very dramatic tale, and we bought the full brother for $220,000 at the Gold Coast sales, the first foal out of the mare, Redoute's Choice, beautiful colt. He was let go into a spelling paddock and unfortunately ran into a fence and killed himself. And it was unbelievable shock. He was a very quiet colt. So we come out the next year, and my wife and I fell in love with the next brother, and we thought we'd buy him, and we did, and we got him quite cheap. He was a windsucker, he wasn't very big, so nobody went for him, and we only paid $40,000. So that was quite dramatic in itself, to think that how could you get a Redoute's Choice for $40,000, and then out of a daughter of a Golden Slipper winner. So we were very excited about that. And then he jumps out and runs like a jet and wins the Blue Diamond Prelude. He's back near the rear and wins by four lengths. And we're thinking, here we go. We've got a Blue Diamond. We've got a stay-in. It's all going great. And He's trotting cantering at Cranbourne, 5:15, with Ivan Culliver on board, and has a heart attack and dies, just like that. And they did a full autopsy, couldn't work out why, don't know why, just happened, one of those freakish things. So the whole thing surrounding him and his brother and the purchasing, getting him cheap, having him run so fast, there was all these dramatic situations. But at the end of the day, we went from rooster one day, feather dust to the next, just overnight like that.
How do you explain that to the owners?
It's extremely difficult, and these days you don't have as much hands-on communication with your client base because of the size of the partnerships. A lot of partnerships now have 20 shares, and it's hard to ring 20 people and repeat that story. So you'll put a lot of your info goes out on one statement on an audio. It's like you're talking to each one of them at the same time, and then I send it out. And it broke my heart that morning to send it out. I think I sent it at about 6 o'clock in the morning. And when an owner gets a message at 6 o'clock in the morning, they're normally concerned in the first place. Why is he
been there and done that?
Exactly. So there's no other way to deliver it other than, guys, this is what happened. And I was a partner with them, so I shared all that emotion with them. Consoling the staff, talking to them. Ivan Culliver was pinned under the horse. Luckily, he wasn't hurt. He was distraught because he knows he's worked with me from the duration of our career. So, yeah, there was a lot of emotion and such a massive down when the dust settled and you think, oh, my God, you just went from having potentially the Blue Diamond favourite to nothing, just like that, not even a horse to go on with. If he had been injured and couldn't race again, that would have been heartbreaking, but we would have been able to send him at stud. He had the pedigree to be a stay-in. We could have, his legacy could have lived on, but we got nothing at all. So it was, very sad.
Flip the coin and we go back to a wonderful horse called Dandy Kid. Was it 15 wins at Moonee Valley?
15 wins at Moonee Valley, and just goes to show horses can come from anywhere. His breeder, Billy Watts, said to me, go and have a look. He used to let me pick out a horse each year up at Berrigan. So my mate Dean Lester took me for a drive, and we picked this little Demas horse out of the paddock. And he was broken in, had 6 months in the paddock. And when he come into training on the 1st of February, 3 months later, he wins 4 straight and ends up winning 19 races and 15 at the Valley. And I think Bill put him together from the 1st of February. He said that there was 10 guys went in. They were 10% shares back then. And $1,000 each, all expenses were paid to the 1st of Feb. They had to pay from February on, from birth right through. So for 10 grand, they got into the horse, 1,000 each, and within his first month of racing, he won 100 grand. And it was just an incredible ride, and he won his first 4. He started racing in the May as a 2-year-old, and he retired a last start winner at Moonee Valley at the age of 10. So we've seen the ownership group grew and grew and grew. There was husbands and wives and kids, and next minute there's grandkids and neighbours. And I think the last winning photo at Moonee Valley, I didn't know he had that many owners. So he gave us 8 years of fantastic fun and just a wonderful horse. And, and it's a record that will never be broken because they're going to change the configuration of the track and all those sorts of things. So he will have... you'll have that record forever.
Yeah. He had a cult following. He was just a star. I'd love calling him at Moonee Valley. He made you lift on the day because there's so many people involved.
Well, I've been lucky enough to see some wonderful, return to scales at Moonee Valley, and you see the Cox Plate winners and all that. And it was the most humbling and day, and it just felt so wonderful the day he won his last start. And the crowd, they just got behind him. And he wasn't a Group 1 horse, but it just felt like I was walking down there with Kingston Town winning his third Cox Plate. It was just amazing. And that's what he did for us and what he did for all the stable and all the apprentices that rode him. He was very rarely ridden by a senior. I used to claim on him, and all those apprentices come through and learnt their craft and won a lot of races on him. And he gave us so much joy, and that's why we do it. And he personified horse ownership, really.
Yeah, no question of that. Rob Griffiths, my special guest here this morning on This Is Your Racing Life, for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating life. Rob, a lifetime in racing. Rob Griffiths, my guest this morning. And you've put a fair bit back into the game. You've been heavily involved in the Trainers Association. What's your role?
Well, I'm now federal president and also state president for Victoria. So I become state president, and then Colin Alderson retired. So I took over that role as federal. And yeah, I like to put back in. The industry's been very good to me. As I said earlier, leaving school at 14 years of age and coming into the industry, everything I know is racing. So if I can put anything back that's productive and beneficial to co-trainers and the industry in general, yeah, that's what I've always done.
The situation with owners not paying, it seems to be always with us. It's been with us for as long as I've been involved in racing. I haven't been guilty of that. But how do you get around it? Because effectively, if the owner doesn't pay, the food chain stops. And you become the funder. Basically, you become the person that funds the horse, you the trainer. It means that the farrier then has trouble being paid, the feed merchant, the dentist, the horse dentist, and it can even sort of go down to staff as well. How do you get around that?
Yeah, well, it's been a difficult topic and a topic that, you know, has failed trainers for years in racing. As you pointed out then, a lot of times when a trainer sends out an account for a horse for services rendered, quite often only 30 or 40% of the money is the trainer's, because they might be collecting money for all these other industry people, be race acceptances for the club, whether it be the farrier and dentist and all the other people that need to be paid. So if you get one of the cogs in the wheel that doesn't settle their account, all of a sudden the trainer becomes the trust fund to prop up the difference and cover the slack and make sure that everyone gets paid. So trainers can't afford to have any bad debt, because most of them are charging, their day rate is quite often not always as much as their costs. So they rely, a lot of trainers have done in the past and will do into the future, rely on training winners to prop up the difference, where the trainer's model should be the winners should be their cream, So the ATA has worked extremely hard with all the PRAs and different people to try and make the process better and more watertight, so that we can control bad debt. And there's a new trainers reform model coming in. I think it kicks off 1st of May, which will, I haven't got all the detail in my head to sort of do it justice at the moment, but it basically encapsulates every owner. So when a horse is purchased and a new ownership form is done, or a horse is transferred into a new owner, every horse throughout any part of Australia, it doesn't matter what state you're in, they fall under the category of these rules and regulations. So what happens is if a person falls behind, the trainer in question has a chance to then say, sorry, Brian, you haven't paid for your 10% of, your horse, so we're going to sell that horse so that we can put, my next-door neighbour would like to race it, and we'll sell that horse and put somebody else into that place and try and weed out the bad debt that way. Now, you might turn around then and say, I'll fix it all up and it's all happy days. Whereas before, we didn't have the opportunity, Brian, to be able to move on that. So quite often you had a horse where, 90% would be return male payers. So you're not going to stop the horse from racing for the benefit of them. And there'll be one person that's dragging their feet and you can't do anything about it. And that'll be just the straw that can break the camel's back. So the industry are all working together, that they know that there's an issue and they're working to solve it, and we're hoping that these new reforms that come in fix that, and that'll be a big plus for trainers.
How does what you hope to implement there, how does that compare to the Wetherby situation in the UK?
I don't know enough about the Wetherby situation. I started to get a little bit lost in the whole detail of everything. There were so many. This has been going on for so long. We've been back and forth, and I left a lot of the detail up to our CEO Andrew Nicol and John Arducci, who have handled this. John's done a lot of work on this for the last 15 years. So, we thought this was coming in a couple of years ago. Then a couple of the states weren't sort of happy with how it was going to unfold, because it started as a credit card system and so on. So I think how I think it works better is that it's more individualised, in the sense that I don't have to tackle the other 90% of the ownership group. I can just say, look, guys, girls, there's one of the owners in the horse, unfortunately I have to name them, they're dragging their feet, we're going to sell the 10%, we're allowed to do that. The horse might be worth 10 grand, debt might only be one. We might have to get the money and send out a refund to the person that's not paying. But at least it gives the ownership group that's existing a chance to buy that share, or it goes out to other owners and so on. But what it does do it cleans up a niche in the market that's been niggling at everyone for a long time. And I think that there's only really about 5% of problems when you look at it all, but it's 5% that trainers can't afford to lose, you know. So I think it'll work. We're optimistic that it will. I think it's a fair system because there's also a disputes part of it that gives owners a chance to have their say if they feel as though that they're not paying the way because they're not happy with the service, you know. So they have a chance to say we're not happy with the trainer that's training our horse. And so, but it should be quite a fast and effective system, and that's what we need because we've never been able to speed up the process in the past.
I think it's a great idea because something had to happen and it gives you some protection.
Yeah, and look, if it doesn't quite work as good as we all think, the fact that we're bringing it in and unrolling it and rolling it out, I should say, and see how it works, the fact from that point on, the data we get back from how it works will help tighten it up and make it better as it goes. But at least it's a step in the right direction for everyone.
A Trainers Trust has been set up with seed funding from the government. This was set up in September of 2015. To look after your participants that may have been injured, may have a permanent disability, may have financial hardship, may have a family breakdown. And this is, you know, there's the black dog thing that we talk about with trainers that suffer from depression. And it's there. It's very real. It's very stark. It's in our face.
Absolutely is. You know, one of my best mates and former work colleague, Tony Vazel, who I was riding for and stable foreman for before I trained, he's succumbed to that pressure, you know. And I think that it's probably there's probably not as much awareness about it in trainers in racing, and there should be. And we're really working hard at the ATA to do that. You know, we've ramped up the amount of people that we have with our new CEO, Andrew Nicol, and we've also got an independent chairman in Merv Hill as well, which will really help us ramp up that whole awareness and get it out there. Because at the end of the day, I was coming home from an interstate travel and a gentleman sitting beside me were having a beer and he said, what do you do? I said, I've got an expectation management company in Melbourne. And he said, what's that? And I said, I train racehorses. Well, he pissed himself laughing. He nearly choked on his beer. But it's true. And it's what we do. And what happens is that those expectations don't always go the right way. So a big part of a trainer has to deal with, you know, if there's 20 owners in the horse and the horse runs poorly or the jockey has a bad day or the horse has a bad day, you might get some negativity, some bad emails. You got to deal with it. You might have some staff that need cancelling and guidance because a horse was injured, like you mentioned before with Burnstone. So you might have some deck controls that the trainer has to deal with. You might have some, you know, other deck controls there that the feed man won't deliver feed because he's not getting paid, so you've got to deal with that. Then you've got to do your work in the morning, and then you've got to go to the races, and then you've got to also somewhere in there be a family man and a husband and a dad and all sorts of things. So with all of those pressures adding up and then 7-day racing, where does the trainer turn? And you can see why some of these trainers have succumbed to black dog and depression and all the things that we talk about. So this, what we're setting up now is for trainers to have somewhere to go and, you know, talk to someone about their issues and just rather than, you know, looking at the bottom of a bottle or, you know, turning to depression or alcohol or anything like that, I think it's a really good thing. And if it gets awareness out there, and I think the other thing that's attached to this is joint trainers, and that's to break the back of that pressure. And we're seeing more and more of it now with the 7-day racing. I think it's the thing that's going to stay, and that'll help assist, because at the end of the day, there is a lot of jobs that a trainer is effectively taken on over the as it's evolved into 7-day racing.
Tell me about Cranbourne, the training centre there.
Oh, I'm biased. I think it's the best in Australia. It's the only training complex that doesn't coexist with racing, so there's no pressures of race days. It's got so many wonderful tracks, and we've got all these trail tracks, and we're minutes away from four beaches, and we've got hill tracks, and you can do 10 things with a horse in 10 different days without doing the same thing twice. You can keep a horse in training a long, long time, which is so much more cost-effective for the owners. The winners that come out of there are unbelievable. It doesn't get the same opportunities as some tracks. You know, what I mean by that is that a lot of the top lots that will come out of here this week and Sydney Easter and Gold Coast might, you know, find their way to Euroa or Ballarat now or Flemington, Caulfield and so on. So it's hard to quantitate the success versus opportunity, but we churn out a lot of winners. But I very rarely see a horse come to Cranbourne and lose form. They nearly always go up in rating points, and I think that they're very happy in that environment. We're so close to all the metro facilities in terms of race meetings, and we've got the designated training track on all the acreage that we got, and our tracks are wide, Brian. They're 1.5 mile grass tracks and 30 metres wide. Our inside track that we don't even put markers on is 1,400 metres around. And, that's our, we call that our baby track. We've got three inside tracks and four barrier facilities and pools and water walkers to come and all sorts of things. So the horse gets absolutely everything.
Yeah. Absolutely brilliant. Fantastic news to read that Racing Victoria will bring in as a trial a raceless day. No racing on a Monday as from January of 2018. To March. You'll double up on a Wednesday. That's fantastic. You guys must have had some input.
Yeah, they've been asking for a while on that, and we always were concerned about, do you let go of a punting day? Does the marketplace turn their energies into other forms of gambling? And we need to turn over for prize money. So there's a lot of talk being discussed over this point for some time. The figures on a Monday were never quite as good, so I thought that's probably the right day. I hope trainers can take advantage of it. In Cranbourne we do all our trials on a Monday, so is it going to make any difference to us not having a race day? We'll find out. But you've got to try these things, I think that let's hope that they work for us, and if they don't work for us and we end up back in the seven-day racing, I think the best thing we can do I say this to other trainers that are coming along and said, ask me my advice. I said, design a model yourself. If you only want to race 3 days, just race 3 days and try and do it that way. But this is a step in the right direction. The industry's, understanding that there's a lot of needs and on trainers. So let's see how it goes. It could work fantastic.
The Vobis scheme, the Vobis Gold and the Vobis scheme, which is linked to this sale that we're talking about that starts tomorrow, I don't think people really can get the grip of how important it is and how fantastic it is for owners.
Oh, it's just brilliant. To get extra, opportunities to earn income, that revenue is going to sustain people to continue to race. I was buying here mainly all the time because of the Vobis, and I felt as I was pigeonholing myself into just buying sort of one area. So I went to New Zealand and bought some horses, and they did really well, but then the Vobis Gold come in. And now when I got back and I'm looking at the horses that I've got in training, the one with the Vobis Gold could potentially earn 3 times the amount of money that the horse that didn't have the bonus scheme. So it was crazy not to buy. If you're based in Victoria, you're crazy not to have Vobis. It's made the prices go up a bit, for sure, but that's healthy for the breeders. But the revenue stream for the Vobis is just incredible, and some of these, some of the horses can rack up big amounts of money really quickly. And the horse that Darren Weirs at the moment that keeps winning the Vobis Gold races, his name escapes me now, leads all the way, but he's won 700 grand or something now. It's just an amazing scheme. And if we can keep getting, great income like that. Dandy Kid was a Vobis horse. He won a lot of money. We've had a lot of good Vobis horses over the years. And that type of money, it comes back into the system. It helps ownership groups reinvest again. Because they do, we're all optimists, we all reinvest it. So it's been a fantastic scheme.
If I put a syndicate together and we pay $60,000 or $70,000 for a horse through the Melbourne sale, and we've Vobis qualified, the trick is to try and get out of the horse as quickly as possible in terms of pay for the horse, pay for his purchase price, and the rest you can control.
Absolutely, and sometimes you can go to a Vobis maiden now and come out first prize $30,000.
Yeah.
First prize. And if the horse has that type of talent to win, there's a fair chance that that horse in question's had a couple of seconds, a third, and then wins a 64 Vobis race. Next minute they've amassed 100 grand, just like that. And they might be a restricted grade horse. So it gives your owners the chance to stay in the industry and be self-supported by that type of revenue stream. So I think it's just a brilliant idea, and it's great for the breeders, because I ran into one of the breeders of our horse, Capanello. We didn't pay a lot of money for him. We bought him at Sydney Classic Sale a couple of years ago for $24,000, and he loves it. He's got 15 grand in dividends from him since he sold him, So, they're the sort of things that, to hear it from the breeders as well, not just the trainer's getting 10%, the jockey's getting 5%, the owners are getting a benefit.
Yeah, it's spread around.
Just brilliant. Brilliant scheme, man.
Good catalogue, this one?
Oh, it's fantastic. This catalogue each year gets stronger and stronger. It's amazing, really. You could think, you know, it can't get any stronger, and it does. There's so many great horses come out of Melbourne Premier these days that you can see why all the buyers are coming here, and more internationals now too, which makes it harder to buy, but there's some really good quality horses.
Good to chat with you, Rob. It's the longest I've ever had with you, sitting down here as we speak here at the Yearling Sales, seeing the horses being trotted out, people looking at them, you know, with beauties in the eye of the beholder, as they say. But it's had such a fantastic record, this particular sale, and we're forever grateful with Phil Zavoma coming through this sale, being passed in at 50 grand, and of course the great one, Black Caviar, came through here. Look after yourself, lots of success. I must admit that, you know, your name is right up there with being the best in the business, and I know you've worked pretty hard to get to where you are.
Thanks very much, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
Good on you. Robbie Griffiths, special guest this morning. This is Your Racing Life.